This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Over the last week, we've seen some remarkable headlines about cities and states promising real action on police violence and racial justice. Promises that would have seemed impossible just a few weeks ago. At George Floyd's funeral in Houston, the Reverend Al Sharpton said that he was encouraged by how white people have responded with demands for change.
Floyd could have been anybody. But then the reaction was not anything. Because somewhere I read in the Bible that God said he would pour out his spirit among all flesh. And that's why when I heard them talking about, they never thought they'd see young whites marching like they marching now. All over the world, I've seen grandchildren of slave masters tearing down slave master statue over in England and put it in the river. I'll pour out my spirit among all flesh. I've seen whites walking past curfews saying Black Lives Matter, no justice, no peace. I'll pour out my spirit among all flesh.
It may be that the shock and horror of Floyd's death before our eyes, on video, has finally shaken millions of white people from years of drift and complacency. For a long time, Suzanne Plisak has been talking to white people about the reality of entrenched racism. She's a trainer with the Racial Equity Institute and a co-founder of that group. Suzanne Plisak spoke with The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden.
So I want to put our cards on the table right away and point out that you're a white woman from the South and I'm a white woman from the North. And that will inform our discussion. How did you become engaged with this kind of work?
It's very difficult to really capture what all the touch points were, but to be a little white and linear, I can tell you essentially, I found early in my life a real sadness for people who were hurt, who were harmed, who were living in poverty. After the birth of my children, that came into sharper focus. And as they enter school, it came into still sharper focus as I saw the contrast between what was available to my children and what was not available to children of color often, not always, often. So it seemed to me at that time that the way we dealt with the child who came to school in flip-flops in January was to provide shoes. And it seemed to me at the time that provision of needs was very, very important. And it is important. It's not unimportant. But as you do that, you soon realize that you have done nothing to prevent those needs from occurring again. So I moved from that very charity approach into policy needs to be changed. We have got to do something in a larger way to get at the root causes. Of course, you don't do that very long before you realize that even when policy changes, that there is something in our culture, a narrative that continues to pull back those successes that you have. And I had the great gift of coming to a training that explained to me, that this one was from by the People's Institute at the time, that that thing was racism. And then we decided to form the Racial Equity Institute and to do the work of bringing an analysis to people that would make them more effective in the work they do.
Many companies offer diversity training, but you know, those sessions have almost no effect, if any, on how white Americans go about their lives. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what makes the tactics and mission of the Racial Equity Institute different.
Yeah, we don't do diversity training. We don't do prejudice reduction. All of those things have their values, I'm sure. But even if you were able to make people more sensitive and reduce prejudice and bigotry and racial prejudice, you then send them out into a world that is operating from a structure that promotes the supremacy of white people, that ensures that whatever you do is going to disproportionately advantage white people, even when that's not your intent. And that division is just, it continues to work well because we don't understand it. We don't understand where it's coming from. And we continue to put it in the context of mean-spirited, racially charged people and statements and acts. Those things are bad. They're incredibly bad and wrong. But it's important to understand that racism happens. And this is the biggest lesson of my life, without my intent, that we are set up for it to happen. And so I have to understand that I benefit from that, whether I want to as a white person or not. I have to further understand it doesn't make me a bad, immoral person. It makes me a beneficiary of a system set up hundreds of years ago to benefit people who have come to be called white.
Can you give us an example of how a well-meaning organization you've worked with, determined to pursue racial diversity and all of the best values, has been taken aback by what you have to tell them?
Well, I think most of them are taken aback. But we were called some years ago to a public-private partnership, a school actually that had been created to be a multicultural school. They had all the very best intents. They, however, were having a very difficult time recruiting and retaining students and faculty of color. So the night before we did our training, the core of the school, all white, took us out to dinner, and they began to tell us all the things they had done to become multicultural. And it was a long list. They would bring in, one of their favorite things was to have what we call the International Day, you know, to bring in people from many cultures and have them share their culture and their cultural ways. And that, you know, they brought in everybody. In addition to that, they did many things that they thought would be appealing to people of color. They would do spoken word, they would do stepping, they did, you name it, they did it. And our very wise director, Dina Hayes Green, said to them at the end of this litany, "So what did you do for white people?" And their jaw dropped. Because you see, the culture that was keeping them from attracting and retaining students and faculty of color was the one culture they had not examined. It's white culture. It's our way of being in the world, our set of values. And the invitation they issued is very much like the invitation we as white people have issued since the Civil Rights Act, which is come be like us. Don't bring your ways of being, don't bring your ways of knowing, come be like us.
So how should groups like that go about what they're doing? That's a huge project. It involves, you know, changing the deepest preconceptions that everyone has about him and herself.
We believe it starts with an understanding of how we got here. Then we need an understanding of how white organizational culture operates, how it is different from more relational cultures. We need an understanding that we are, in fact, as white people, not wrong and bad, but operating out of a culture that we impose on other people. It's okay to have your culture. It's okay to be who you are in the world based on your history. It's not okay to impose your way of being on everybody else and to make laws and build structures and build institutions based on that. And that's hard. That's hard. But that study, that understanding's got to be the first step.
You know, so much of this problem, I think, derives from Americans' ignorance of our actual history as it played out. You argue that the origins of the concept of whiteness, which is an artificial concept, stretches back hundreds of years. The story of John Ponch really brings this home. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, John Ponch was an African indentured servant. He was not kidnapped and enslaved, although it's a pretty fine line. This is early in the 1600s. John Ponch was an African indentured servant who ran away with a Dutchman and a Scotsman. They ran away together, but they got caught. The Dutchman and Scotsman are sentenced to 4 additional years of servitude, 1 to the master to whom they were already indentured and 3 to the colony. But John Ponch is sentenced to perpetual servitude. Now, that was done not because he was the leader or had some special part, although I'm sure there were all kinds of explanations in the time, but to ensure the allegiance of the white indentured servants to the white people at the top. It was important to ensure that people of color who were either indentured servants or kidnapped and enslaved, and white people who were largely indentured servants, did not come together and challenge the system oppressing them. Your allegiance now is not to the black African you've been running away with. It is to the people who gave you this little thing. And we have done that as white people, knowingly and unknowingly, for the subsequent 300 years.
It's just extraordinary. So the protests following the killing of George Floyd do seem to have had some clear effect.
Yes.
It looks to me like this could be an inflection point. Does it look that way to you?
It absolutely does. I mean, the question is sustaining the momentum, showing up, not just for the protests, but when the protests are over, showing up again the next day and the next for all the things that we need to continue to fight for. What we teach is that the things that we face in this world, the injustice that we face in this world, organizing is essentially the answer, that we need to learn to organize outside of institutions and inside of institutions, that building a base of power to challenge power at those grassroots levels and then beyond that is what we need to be doing. I mean, it is the work. And that means you've got to show up again the next day.
So there is a tendency after incidents of racially motivated violence in white culture, and you can see it right now playing out in the media, to ask people of color for their insights about racism. But scholars and activists, and even some of our recent presidential candidates, have been pointing out what you're pointing out, that systemic racism is really a white problem. So what role do conversations among white communities or conversations between white people like you and I are having play in confronting and addressing the problem of systemic racism?
Well, I think that they can play a very big role. The potential, I would say, is absolutely there. I have been somewhat heartened by the number of statements that companies and organizations and individuals have come out with condemning these recent acts of brutal, unconscionable violence. So to speak out against such things is always an important thing to do. We had a mentor years ago who said, if you can get 3 white people with no people of color present to speak out against racism, you've done revolutionary work. I didn't believe it until I tried.
Wow.
But that speaking is important. And to stop at that will be the tragedy compounding the tragedy. I mean, one of the things that should be respectfully and compassionately asked of all of these statements, all of these speakers, is where have you been? There have been opportunities every day to speak out against, to stand against institutional racism. Where have you been in the health disparity, racial health disparities, horror, the achievement gap, the disparities in lending, in the justice system? We've got to ask ourselves, where have we been? as this problem, this institutional structural problem continued to take stronger and stronger hold of our country.
Suzanne Plisak is a co-founder of the Racial Equity Institute, and she spoke with Dorothy Wickenden, our executive editor and the host of The New Yorker's podcast, Politics and More. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.